You're listening to a University of Minnesota Bookstore author event podcast, recorded live from our location in Kauffman Memorial Union on the U of M's Twin Cities campus. For more information on upcoming author events, please visit our website at bookstore.umn.edu.
Our guest today is Rachel Schuchert. She is a playwright and performer and the author of Have You No Shame and other regrettable stories, as well as her new book, Everything Is Going to Be Great, an underfunded and overexposed European grand tour. Her writing has appeared in McSweeney's and Hebe and on Salon, Slate, Gawker, Nerve, and The Daily Beast. She's also been featured on National Public Radio and contributed to numerous print anthologies, including the recently released Click, When We Knew We Were Feminists. She's a contributing editor at Tablet Magazine, and she is also an alumnus of Ars Nova's illustrious playgroup. Born and raised in Omaha, Nebraska, she received a BFA from the Tisch School of the Arts and now lives in New York City with her husband and her bipolar cat. Please join me in welcoming Rachel Schuchert.
Hi, it's very, very nice to see you all. It's a small but mighty group, so thank you so much for coming. I'm really excited to be here. It's been a long time since I was in Minneapolis, and I've always loved this city, and this student center is incredible. It's like the future. It's like a space station or something. When I was at NYU, like the second that I arrived, they completely demolished our student center, and it was not rebuilt until about 2 years after I graduated, so I've never had this experience of being in this place. So thank you again for coming. This is my new book, Everything Is Going to Be Great, and I'm going to read a little bit from one section of it. And then I have a very good friend, Max Sparber, who I'm very excited to have here, who's also a writer and was sort of a mentor to me when I was very young, growing up in Omaha. So I asked him if he would read just a little bit of something. And then after that, we'll do a little Q&A and I'll sign books and talk to anybody who wants to talk to me. So just to give you this little context of this particular section, the book chronicles about 2 years that I spent living in Europe directly after college. I kind of graduated from NYU and had no prospects and no hope for my life. And I sort of ran away to Europe thinking that if my life was going to be frustrating and difficult, I at least wanted it to be frustrating and difficult in new and foreign ways. I had gotten a very, very small role, a sort of non-speaking, non-paying role with a play that was directed by a very famous director in New York. And I kind of piggybacked on the back of this European tour that we took, and I wound up sort of just staying. My passport went unstamped, and I remained legally in a technical sense. And I wound up sort of settling down in Amsterdam, which is where this particular story takes place. So to give a little background of where we're going to jump in, I was hanging out a lot alone in cafes, like sort of trying to write and just to have something to do and feeling lonely. And I was approached by this sort of group of Italian men who claimed to be dental students, at least some of them did, and told me that they wanted to invite me to this big dinner party they were having. And I was like, yeah, I don't think so, buddy. This is how people get sex trafficked. You know, I go to your dinner party, and the next thing I know, I'm handcuffed to a mattress while some Uzbek shoves a curling iron up my ass and tells me that he loves me. So I said that I was not going to go to this party. And then, as luck would have it, as soon as I get back to my roommates in Holland, we're all having dinner, and I bite into this roll, and this cap on my tooth comes off, and I swallow it. And I'm like freaking out. It starts to get infected. And all of my Dutch friends, everybody Dutch, is like, well, you don't have the insurance, so it's going to be incredibly expensive to have your tooth fixed. It's going to be very, very expensive. We can get you to the dentist, but it's going to cost just so much money. And I had no money. I mean, I had literally zero euros. I mean, the dollars was like 30 cents at the time or something. So I started to panic, especially as my tooth got it more and more painful and more infected. And finally, my friend was like, well, if you know your own dentist, maybe you can go. So I decided that I would, in fact, go to the dinner party of these Italian dental students with the hope that maybe they could fix my tooth for free or for a little amount of money, and that I would do whatever it took, and that the risk of being sold into sexual slavery was less painful than my molar. So that's that's where we are when this little episode begins. I heard footsteps and held my breath, prepared for anything. The door swung open, revealing a small, dark man dressed in white and covered from head to toe in an even dusting of flour, as though he were about to be sautéed for a giant supper. From the shadows, Yvonne's face appeared over one of the man's powdery shoulders. Bellissima! Ivan cried. He lunged for me, planting several noisy kisses on my cheeks before crushing me against his chest in a rib-cracking embrace and wedging his pelvis carefully next to mine in order to give our clothed genitals a proper chance to get acquainted. All day long, Ivan said, clasping my head in his hands, as I think I will see you tonight. My heart is a-pounding, pounding, like in the tale of Poe. I am a writer. He was a writer, that's what he told me. The other ones were dentists. But now, at last, bellissima, you are here. He rained another volley of kisses on my face, my eyelids, my hair. I screwed up my face and turned my head like a little kid deflecting the unwelcome saliva of an ancient aunt. Was that the ravioli guy? Si, si, Zangelo. I am supposed to answer the door, but I am bringing the tables and I cannot hear. He seemed so angry. Pah! He is angry to leave his sauce. He curses at us, Ivan said. Angelo has no lover, he added. He has only his pasta. I wanted to make it very clear to him that we were not lovers, that any acts I might feel compelled to engage in for the sake of my infected molar had nothing to do with love. But he was already ushering me inside the basement, where several people sat at a long table drinking red wine. Ivan introduced me. There was Marco, who with his tiny black beard and large hoop earring appeared to be taking a night off from his job as the bride auctioneer in the Pirates of the Caribbean ride. Marco had paired his white jeans with an orange paisley shirt unbuttoned to the navel, and as he leaned forward to kiss me once on each cheek and once on the mouth, I could feel that the shirt was made of washable silk, like the colorful blouses the boys at Hebrew school used to wear to bar mitzvah parties. "Are you a dentist, too?" I asked. Ivan quickly translated my question for Marco, who threw his head back, laughing, and kissed me sloppily on the nostril, which was creative. The heavy gold crucifix he wore around his neck thudded passionately against my clavicle.
Bellissima, said Marco. Ti amo, ti amo.
Beside Marco was a wraith-like couple clothed in narrow black, their elegant heads emerging from clouds of cigarette smoke and tangled skeins of slim silk scarves. This is Alessandra, Ivan said, pointing his chin toward the female of the pair. Alessandra is now the woman of Tad, he whispered, but she was once my lover. Even if he hadn't told me, I would have known from the way she jumped up too eagerly to greet me, her coal-rimmed eyes widening with ersatz friendliness as she embraced me. Ivan pulled me aside under the pretext of hugging and kissing me some more.
Tad is a secret homosexual, he murmured as he thrust his tongue into my ear canal. Alessandra soon will tire of him. She will look again for a real man.
I jerked away, running the tip of my own tongue off the dead stump of my tooth. "Where's Enzo?" I asked. "Isn't he coming tonight?"
"Si, si, he's with Fabrizio, his brother," Ivan said. "Together they are gathering more wine."
Enzo and Fabrizio were, in fact, identical twins, although Fabrizio had distinguished himself from his brother by means of a large diamond earring and a cropped leather vest which he wore over his bare chest. His left bicep was also tattooed with a flattering likeness of Jesus, grimacing under a crown of very convincing thorns. "It's so lifelike," I said politely, as Fabrizio urged me to trace Jesus' anguished mouth with my forefinger. "You can almost feel the scourging." Fabrizio evidently took this as a compliment, seizing my index finger and swirling it around the inside of his mouth. I looked to Ivan for help, but he just smiled, swinging an arm around my waist.
"Come," he said, "drink some wine. The other guests will soon arrive."
Every once in a while, you find yourself at a party that feels like what you pictured as a child when you imagined what adulthood must be like. Dark, semi-secret, filled with beautiful people from all walks of life. New acquaintances and old friends laughed and joked, welcomed each other with wide, wine-stained smiles. In one corner, Fabrizio was making bicep Jesus dance for a pair of well-dressed Swedes. In another, Enzo was grinding his pelvis to the delight of a table of German backpackers. The Italians had roamed the streets looking for talent, I thought, casting the perfect party. Ivan nestled next to me, sopping up the sauce from my plate with a chunk of bread and placing it against my tongue. The flavor filled my mouth, and he buried his face against the nape of my neck, covering my hairline with damp kisses. I didn't mind anymore. I was beyond caring. There's a time and a place for self-determination, and a great party for shirtless Italians where nobody speaks English is not one of them. After the feasting, we danced a Brazilian bossa nova until the crowd started to thin and the party moved to the living room upstairs. Ivan curled up beside me.
"You are too beautiful," he muttered thickly. "I can no longer control myself. Please, we must go now to the bed."
I couldn't pretend I didn't know this was coming, but Ivan had started to grow on me. If I had to sleep with any of them, it would be him. He'd read Turgenev. And this had to be an important step on the road back to dental health.
"I fuck your friend, now fix my crown."
I rose and followed him up a flight of Dutch steps, the kind so steep that depending on your level of intoxication, you sometimes have to climb on your hands and knees. Just before we reached the top, we were stopped by an anguished shriek. Alessandra stood at the foot of the stairs, screaming and crying as though she would die.
"Ach," she says, "I am in her blood. She is in my blood. I will never be free of her," Ivan said disgustedly.
He roared something back. "I tell her she is in my blood like a disease, like the AIDS." Mentioning AIDS before casual sex is a bit like wondering aloud where the detonator is on an airplane. But before I could flee down the steps and into the night, Alessandra dissolved into tears and threw herself across the stairs, shouting and pointing at me between great hiccuping intakes of breath.
"Ah," Ivan groaned, "now she curses you. You are a whore. You should be raped by dogs. You should never give birth to a child. No, you should have a child, and the child should be a monster. He's very typical."
Alessandra lay crumpled on the floor, a lump in beautiful puddle convulsing with sobs. "Maybe we should just forget about the sex," I said hopefully. I may have been willing to go through with this, but as prostitutes and married people know, willing and eager are two very different things.
She seems really upset. "No, no, no," commanded Ivan. "She is dead to me. I do not love her anymore. Now it is you I love. I love only you."
"Give me a break," I started to say, but Ivan had already whisked me into a bedroom, romantically furnished with several piles of dirty clothes and a bare mattress lying directly on the floor.
"Ah!"
Out of nowhere, a hulking apparition had leapt from behind the door and tackled me onto the bed. It was Marco, resplendently nude apart from his neck chains and a mesh zebra print G-string.
"Bellissima!"
he shrieked and pinned me flat on my back between his walnut-colored thighs. I screamed, beating his shoulders with my handbag, but Ivan, also suddenly minus his shirt and pants, was atop me as well, rhythmically thrusting his tongue in and out of my mouth in a manner I assumed was meant to remind me of intercourse. On the downstairs end, Marco, quick as a shot, had jerked my panties roughly to one side, threatened to cut off circulation to my upper thigh and begun to lap enthusiastically at my pubic hair. I made the horrible mistake of looking down. With his pink tongue darting out of his scrubby black beard, it looked like another vagina was licking my vagina, like one of those pictures within a picture within a picture that go on forever and eventually drive you insane.
"No!" I cried, clutching his head in my hands and forcing it away. "Stop it! Do not be ashamed! Bellissima!" Marco bellowed. "It tastes so good!"
Ivan stroked my hair, covering my face with conciliatory little kisses.
"It's okay, cara mia. I love you. I love you." "No means no," I shouted. "I am not going to have sex with you. Definitely not with both of you."
"No, no, no. Of course not," Ivan murmured sweetly. "We will not have the sex. We will just make the love."
And with that important clarification, he resumed his ferocious tongue thrust while the befuddled Marco returned happily to his post between my legs. "I'm being date raped," I thought. "I'm fully being threesome date raped." Then Marco's insistent tongue hit its target, and in spite of myself, I gasped. This was a catastrophe.
"Yes, yes," muttered Ivan, "you are beginning to relax."
He grabbed my hand and forced it onto his penis. I felt something strange under my fingers, something that wasn't supposed to be there. When my sister was little, she contracted ringworm from a cat named Potato. For weeks, her scalp was laced with scaly, yellowish streaks that made me recoil from her whenever she came near me. It appeared that something similar had happened to Ivan. A raised, worm-shaped tendril was snaking over the head and creepily circling the shaft. That did it. I wanted my tooth fixed, but not enough to get raped and get ringworm in my cervix. This ended now. "Get off me," I shouted, sitting up so abruptly that I clocked Ivan in the face with the top of my head.
"Cara, what is wrong?" Ivan pleaded. "You don't like us?"
"No," I yelled. "I don't. I just wanted to see a dentist." Marco glanced up from his labors, his face falling under its coating of slimy goo. "Look at this," I said, switching on the lamp beside the bed and pulling back my lip to reveal the dead stump.
"Oh, no!" Ivan was on his feet, pulling on his pants. "Cara, why you not say something? We get Enzo, Enzo, Enzo!"
He ran into the hallway. Marco, still in his zebra thong, patted my hand comfortingly.
"It's okay," he murmured kindly. "I'm sorry. It's okay."
"Thank you," I said. Despite the fact that he had sexually assaulted me, I felt fond of him. If we had all been clear about our motives from the start, maybe none of this would have happened. It was a good lesson for the future. Enzo emerged at last, scowling and fully nude. On his stomach, just a few inches before the crest of his massive erection, I noticed his name was tattooed in swirling Gothic letters. E-N-Z-O. I wondered who was down there that might need a reminder. Ivan spoke rapidly, gesturing toward me, and Enzo, looking irritated, grabbed my jaw and forced open my mouth to peer inside.
"He say you lose your tooth," said Ivan. "Umph," I replied, "I don't know."
Ivan said, "He say you will need to put a new, how do you say it, like the hat on the head of a king." crown, I said. Si, si. Enzo tapped the stump with his finger. I wrenched my face away in pain. Can he fix it, I asked. I mean, obviously not right this second, but sometime soon, tomorrow maybe. They conferred. He say he has not yet learned to make such a procedure, Ivan informed me regretfully. If he wants, he will make for you a time to see a true dentist. But he must warn you, it will be very, very expensive. And now he must return to the German girl and his brother. They are waiting for him to finish in the making of the sex. That afternoon, I grimly rode my bicycle to the dentist's office. I'd withdrawn every cent from both my checking accounts and also brought along my passport, my computer, and a few bits of jewelry I hoped I might be able to use as collateral, should it come to that. The dentist worked quickly and silently, injecting my sore gum with Novocaine and expertly fitting a temporary crown over the stump. He scribbled out a prescription for antibiotics on a yellow pad and took me outside to deal with the bill. Okay, he said, I must prepare you. Obviously, you don't have the national insurance, so I have to say it's going to be pretty expensive. I know. I fingered the wad of bills in my pocket mournfully. Just tell me how much it is. He sucked the air between his cheeks in an apologetic hiss and looked down for a moment before he could meet my eye. It is going to be 82 euros. I said, you are fucking kidding me. Thank you. And now I'll have my wonderful friend Max come up and maybe just read a tiny bit of something, if that's okay.
Hi there. My name is Max Sparber. I'm a local writer. I write the Daily Glean column for MinnPost, and I also write plays and short stories. And this is one based on some family legends. When I was a boy, my mother used to tell me parables about her great-grandfather, Wolf Kitsis. Rabbi Kitsis was one of the founders of Hasidic Judaism, an ultra-Orthodox branch of modern Judaism known for its black garments and its mystical, ecstatic devotion. The movement was founded by Rabbi Yisrael ben Eliezer, who is commonly known as the Baal Shem Tov, and my great-grandfather, Wolf Kitsis, was one of his disciples. My mother loved to tell me stories about Wolf Kitsis, which she often did very late at night, hours after I had gone to sleep, when she had just returned from one of her many parties and was quite drunk. Here are four of those stories, and I'll read a few of them. One, the parallel of Wolf Kitsis and the farmer's daughter. One night, Rabbi Kitsis was traveling from Okapi to Podolia. As he rode in his carriage, he remembered the words that the Baal Shem Tov had told him before he began his trip. You will meet many strange women on your journey, and they will tempt you, but you must resist temptation, or you will invite God's disfavor. It got to be very late in the evening, and Wolf Kitsis began to look for a place to board his mares and rest for the night. He came across a farmhouse that was owned by an ancient Russian, who bid him to stay. I am a lonely man, the Russian said, and I am badly in need of company. Come, join me in my household. Take whatever food and vodka you wish. All that is mine is yours but for one thing. I have an 18-year-old granddaughter. She is apple-cheeked and full-bosomed, and no matter how sorely tempted you might be, you must not touch her. And Wolf Kitsis remembered that the admonishment of the Baal Shem Tov, and he promised the Russian that he would not go near his granddaughter. And so Wolf Kitsis and the Russian stayed up very late, talking and joking, as though they were the oldest of friends and toasting each other with vodka. And at last the man slipped off to a deep, satisfied slumber, and Wolf Kitsis rose and went into his room. And when he climbed into his bed, he found a surprise. It was a Russian's granddaughter, apple-cheeked and full-bosomed, unclad of any clothes. And Wolf Kitsis remembered the words of the Baal Shem Tov, and he remembered his promise to the old Russian, and he laughed, and he laughed, and he laughed, and then he made love to the girl, and he had her pose for a series of erotic French postcards. And then he made love to her again, and then he sent her back to her room and tried to sleep, but found he could not sleep. And so he went into her room and made love to her three times more. In the morning, he crept out of the old Russian's house, and he hitched his horse to his wagon and resumed his journey, still laughing. But Wolf Kitsis found the horse would not go where he wanted, but instead turned and went back to Okapi, where the Baal Shem Tov waited with crossed arms. As Wolf Kitsis stepped out of the carriage, the Baal Shem Tov seized him by his arms and remonstrated him. "Did I not tell you that you must resist temptation?" the Baal Shem Tov demanded. "But Rabbi," Wolf Kitsis cried out, "I took photographs." It is for this that Wolf Kitsis is remembered as the Baal Shem Tov's favorite disciple. And I'll read one more. This is called The Parable of Wolf Kitsis and the Barkeep. The Baal Shem Tov and Wolf Kitsis found themselves outside a saloon. They agreed that they were quite thirsty and should enter and drink until they had slaked their thirst. The barkeep was a Lithuanian with a terrible temper, and they decided they should play a trick on him. Wolfkissis would wager the barkeep that he could drink his weight in vodka. If he succeeded, the Lithuanian would have to pay for all the drinks, and pay for whatever the Baal Shem Tov wished to drink as well. They suggested this wager to the barkeep, and he looked Wolfkissis up and down and decided that such a feat would be impossible, as Wolfkissis weighed at least 10 stone. And so he set out a container after container of vodka and watched, amazed, as Wolfkissis consumed every one. Finally, Rabbi Kitsis had drunk 10 stone worth of vodka, and the Lithuanian shook his head astounded. "I did not think it would be possible," the man said, "but here you have done it, and it was an honest wager, and you are honest men, and I will keep my end of the bargain. Drink whatever you like." He set out more liquor for Wolfkissis and the Baal Shem Tov to drink, and they did so with gusto, but as they did so, Wolfkissis found himself perplexed. The Baal Shem Tov saw the shadow fall across his face and begged Wolfkissis to tell him what was troubling him. "The barkeep thinks we're honest men," Wolfkissis said. "And so we are," the Baal Shem Tov responded. "But how honest are we when you performed a miracle to allow me to drink that much alcohol?" Wolfkissis asked. "That was no miracle," the Baal Shem Tov responded. "You are a raging alcoholic."
Okay, I'll answer any questions if anybody has any, and if not, then we'll sign books, and I'd love to talk to anybody. So, no? Okay. Well, thank you all for coming.